Hey, I'm Ashwin, and I'm at a Halloween block party on Mason Avenue, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
That's my guy, Ashwin, rocking the Halloween block party. Tis the season. Thank you, sir. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 994. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our wonderful engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. And I hope you had a wonderful Halloween. My costume was a middle-aged man with some gray hairs popping up. We had a very nice time with the family getting out there trick-or-treating. Hopefully you did too. And here we are in November. Don't forget to get that extra hour in on your time devices, your clocks, your watches. Your phone will do it for you. That's coming up tonight. And speaking of things coming up, hey, we are just a few weeks out from the Outside the Loop 1000th episode taping in front of a live audience at Fitzgerald's, the historic Fitzgerald's nightclub in Berwyn. You can be there. We'd love to see you there. And all you have to do, you can just go to OutsideTheLoopRadio.com or WGNRadio.com, and we will put the link up to reserve your ticket. It is totally free, but you have to RSVP. You could also go to FitzgeraldsNightclub.com. That's coming up Saturday, November 22nd at 3 p.m. So you go and you still have the rest of your evening ahead of you. And just announced some new guests in addition to the wonderful guests that we have lined up. We've got Chicago historian Dominic Pisiga about his new book on Chicago politics. Our good friend Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave, who does the Secret History of Chicago music strip in the Chicago Reader. He'll be there doing a live segment of the Secret History of Chicago music with yours truly. We also have the co-founders of Chicago's first mental health urgent care. And it is such a cool concept. It's opening up in River North. We've got the co-founders coming to the show and live music from local singer-songwriter AJ Rosales. So get your tickets. It's totally free. You could go to FitzgeraldsNightclub.com. The Outside the Loop 1000th taping event. You could be on the radio. You could be on the podcast. We'd love to see you there. And I'm sure we have other stuff planned that I just don't know about. In fact, we do. I just can't talk about it yet. So we'll see you there November 22nd at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn on Roosevelt Road. We've got a great show coming up for you today. Yes, the secret history of Chicago music of a local horn rock band. I love that. And what's the state of local news right now? We'll dive into that new report. Local news is something I am so excited about because it connects us by providing important information about our communities. And part of this whole democracy thing is being informed so we can make decisions about our future as a people. The Local News Initiative at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism recently published its 10th annual State of Local News Report. There are some bright spots when it comes to the future of local news, but there are also many areas of concern. Tim Franklin is a professor and chair in local news at Medill, and he is here with us once again on Outside the Loop. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back, and thanks for your interest in this topic.
It is so important, and I'm just someone, I just love media in general, but I think, you know, especially now, we need to have a robust system of journalists and media to have a check on just everything that's going on here and really just informing people. And you were here on this program a few weeks ago discussing how we get our news, but this report is more of a big picture overview of the state of local news. And so even right. though we're talking about 2024, 2025. This is the 10th year of this project, and you actually go back, you look at some data from as far back as 2005 until now. So we'll get into some of the specifics, but big picture, journalism as we know it, is it shrinking or is it becoming something else? Is it evolving right now?
It's both. And so look, Mike, we're living through what is really a historic transformation of the entire news media industry. It's national news and local news. How people consume news is changing radically. And just like any industry that's undergoing huge disruption, there's both destruction and there's creation. And right now, we're seeing more destruction than we are creation. But I do think there's some signs of optimism, and we can talk about those. But we're really at a critical moment, I think, and there's a lot of urgency around this issue.
Absolutely. And let's start with something that we've talked about before. But really, and you point this out in your report, this is kind of the core of our communities, newspapers. And you report here, since 2005, close to 3,500 newspapers have ceased printing. So tell us what your research found and what you put in this report for last year. What's the most recent data that we have, the state of newspapers as we know them?
Sure. Well, Mike, I mean, look, the business model for newspapers has basically vaporized.
Yeah.
And that's because the advertising revenue, which has been the pillar holding up local news for decades, has shifted to online platforms and to content creators and to others. And so that revenue's gone away. And whenever you lose, you know, the biggest share of your biggest revenue source, you know, over the course of 10 or 12 years, you're going to see a lot of loss. And that's what we're seeing. So the U.S. has now lost almost 40% of all of its newspapers in the last 20 years, almost 40%. And newspapers still are the primary vessel by which people in communities get local community news. So that's what is so troubling about this. And so in the past year, we talk about in the report, we've now gone up to 213 news desert counties. So these are entire counties with no source of local news, no newspaper, no digital site, no public radio, no ethnic media, nothing. And there are now more than 1,500 counties in the U.S. that are down to one local news source. So you add all that up, and there are 50 million Americans with little to no access to local news, which should be concerning. We're losing on average more than two newspapers a week. In the past year, there have been 136 newspapers that have shuttered. That's up from 130 last year. So this loss, this destruction that I mentioned earlier, really shows no signs of abating.
That's amazing that the amount of decrease when it comes to newspapers. And when we think of newspapers today, I mean, I like to be as old school as possible. Let's open up an actual paper. Let's sit down. Let's, you know, feel the print on our fingers.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
now everything is digital, and sometimes there's a paywall. Sometimes there's not, but is that where this is all going now, this sort of paywall format?
Yeah, reader revenue, which is digital subscriptions or memberships, are now the primary revenue source for a lot of local news organizations. And so there's a lot of controversy about paywalls. Should there be paywalls or not? Well, what journalists do is a public service, and it's why I got in to the journalism industry when I did. I won't say how many years ago, but that is the primary revenue source for local news these days. So it's why you see paywalls or pleas for donations or memberships at news organizations. We are seeing growth in digital-only news sites and in startups. Over the past 5 years, there have been more than 300 local news startups across the country. So that's about an average of 60 or so startups every year. That's great. Let's hope that trend continues. The problem is the delta between the startups being created and the newspapers being lost. And right now we're seeing like a 2-to-1 ratio in what's being lost as opposed to what's being created.
And with newspapers, I mean, you point this out in the report, close to 2/3 of the local news outlets in the U.S. are newspapers. That's amazing. And they are disappearing at an alarming rate. And you mentioned news deserts. And boy, we're seeing those on the rise, areas that lack really consistent local reporting. That's how you define them in this report. So news deserts are growing. This is a problem. And this is a problem in Illinois. And we see this really cut across sort of the rural and urban kind of divide there. Can you talk a little bit about where we are with news deserts specifically right now?
Of course. So, and let's talk about Illinois for a second, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So Illinois has five news desert counties. They're all in southern Illinois. There are 42 counties in Illinois that are down to one local news source. So in total, almost half of all Illinois counties are either news deserts or basically what we describe as low information counties. Illinois has lost 46% of its newspapers in the last 20 years and 54% of its newspaper jobs just in the decade that ended last year. So there's the news desert problem, but then they're also, related but separate are just the loss of newspapers in general. And one of the interesting things that's kind of underreported is that about half of the losses of newspapers in Illinois have been in the suburbs. So these are newspapers that were, owned by families or independent owners, and we can talk more about the loss of those, which we also saw in the report, or they were owned by large chains that have consolidated and eliminated those publications. So yes, news deserts are a problem, but we're also seeing this hollowing out of coverage of local news, especially in suburban areas.
So you mentioned ownership right there, and that's something, man, I remember like 20 years ago, or now I guess 25 years ago, specifically with radio, we were talking about the consolidation of ownership when it comes to radio stations, and what does that mean for programming? Right. And certainly that applies to newspapers, but the ownership trend that we're seeing recently, what's going on with that? Because like you're talking about here, the suburbs, those suburban newspapers are great because it's so local, right? You know exactly what's going on in your community, right, on your block. So that's kind of changing now. What's happening with the ownership?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting findings that of the past year. So what's happened in previous years, Mike, is that there were a lot of closures, but they were primarily these big chains that were shutting down their smaller, less profitable publications. But what's happened in the last year is a majority of the closures, of the 136 closures, were these independent, smaller, in many cases, family-run newspapers. And why that is so concerning is that those are the very owners we want to keep. Those are the owners that have, in many cases, long ties to the community. They know the people, they know the institutions, they know the culture, they know the history of the place. And so when we start losing those owners, when they start throwing up their hands and succumbing to the economic pressures, that is really concerning. And then the related to that is that as we lose independent publishers, then more and more of the newspapers end up being owned by chains, several of which are private equity controlled. So that's really concerning.
Yeah. And really, when we see consolidation, we see these newspapers go away, what fills the void is maybe not news. I mean, people go to Facebook and they look to other online sources that are essentially free, but they don't have trained journalists doing journalism. And we see the spread of misinformation and disinformation. That is a serious problem that we're seeing recently on the rise, too.
Yeah, for sure. And so we're actually in the field now with a poll of people who live in news deserts to find out how they consume news. So maybe I'll come back if you'll have me back in a few months when we get that poll back. But anecdotally, what we see is that people go to social media, primarily Facebook groups. And Okay, that's fine. You know, it's great when people are civically engaged on Facebook, but here's the problem. The problem is that there's no journalist typically, often, most of the time, in those Facebook groups that are moderating the conversation, that are doing what journalists do, that are fact-checking, that are checking documents, talking to sources, and looking at past clips to see what the history of an issue is. So as a result, there's more misinformation, disinformation, more rumor mongering that ends up occurring in these Facebook groups. And then there also is an increase of people who turn to national cable news because there's no local news source. They want to be informed. So then they go to cable. And okay, that's fine. But then they often end up in partisan-leaning ecosystems, cocoons, if you will, on those cable channels, and then they turn to news sources that end up reinforcing their own belief sets. And local news is not that. You know, local news is about, yes, big J journalism and accountability reporting, as you talked about earlier, Mike, but it's also about things like weddings and obituaries and high school sports scores,
right,
and what's happening at the local school, the things that really connect us. And so big picture, I worry that what's happening here is that the loss of local news is contributing to this loss of connectedness to our neighbors, this connectedness to our communities, that I think is a larger societal problem.
Tim, we have, as we've been talking about here, a growing news desert problem. And as you mentioned previously, this growing sort of disconnect because of the lack of newspapers and local media. So we have to talk about this in that context. In July, Congress, led by a Republican effort to rescind more than $1 billion that was previously allocated to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that went through, that rescinding of that money. Can you explain the potential impact of this? I know that we're starting to kind of get into some of these public outlets trying to increase their pledge drives. We're hearing that, but specifically with it when it comes to rural areas, because we talked about how these news deserts really impact rural areas. What's the potential impact of what's going on with public broadcasting?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mike, and I'm glad you asked it. As you mentioned, a few months ago, Congress rescinded more than $1 billion in funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And so the implications of that are that, you know, a lot of smaller rural public radio stations, especially ones that in a number of cases are the only remaining news source in their counties, are on the brink. So there are about 1,100 total public radio stations in the U.S. when you include so-called repeater stations. Those are the ones that pick up a primary signal from another station and rebroadcast it. Mm-hmm. And there are now estimates that, you know, we could lose 70 to 80 radio stations over the course of the next year or two. And that's because with smaller rural stations, they really rely and have relied on federal funding. They're about 10% of all the public radio stations get more than 40% of their funding from the federal government. So when you lose almost half of your revenue base, that's really tough to make up. And it's especially tough to make up in smaller rural areas where, you know, there are no community foundations, maybe there are no deep-pocketed investors that can help bail you out. So this is a real problem. There are 9 counties in the U.S. where public radio is the last remaining news source. And I think all 9 of those stations are going to be, you know, struggling. And hopefully we'll make it. Some foundations have stepped up, but there's just not enough foundation money to make up for what's being lost. We sent a reporter to Alaska, just as an example. In the past couple of weeks, we have a story posted on our site about it, where the public radio station in this part of Alaska is the last remaining local news source. And not only are they keeping the community informed across a huge geographic area that's as big as the state of Indiana, but they're also a source of emergency broadcast information. So in the event of a storm or moving into that part of Alaska or some other disaster, that public radio station is what helps keep people safe.
Wow. So the future kind of remains to be seen here when it comes to public broadcasting. How will these stations survive? And we don't know at this point. I mean, we're still relatively early on in all of this, but we'll see what happens politically. Maybe there will be some change in headwinds. We just don't know right now. But Tim, look, let's talk about some bright spots. I mean, we talked a little bit about some startups. That was a good thing. Well, what else do you point out here in your report about local news? What's another bright spot?
Sure. So there is a lot of entrepreneurship happening. I don't mean to sound like a Dr. Doom, we are seeing a lot of local news startups being created by entrepreneurs who are being very creative in developing local news sites. I think that's good. The one thing that's happening is a lot of those are in metro areas. They're not in rural or exurban areas where a lot of the need is. Hopefully we can fill that gap. The other trend is that we found, Mike, in the past year is that we've seen the explosion of these so-called network local news sites. So think Axios, think Patch. These are national news networks that are creating local spots, local franchises in communities to provide community news. And the one advantage of those for the local entrepreneur is that the national network will handle all the back office stuff and those expenses. So you can focus on the journalism and what's happening in the community. But we've seen and did see in the past year a real growth in these so-called network local sites that are part of larger national chains.
So that could be where all this is heading. Again, we don't know, but newspapers technically still around, radio still around, but the political headwinds, we don't know how those are going to shift, but I think it's exciting when we hear about these digital startups and people kind of going out and putting things together. It's just hard to do though, you know?
It is. Yeah, no, one of the hardest things you can do is build an audience from scratch.
Right.
And one of the hardest things you can do is grow revenue from scratch. You know, one of the great success stories in the country is right here in Chicago with Block Club Chicago, which was founded out of the ashes of the old DNA Info, started by journalists, not by millionaires or billionaires. They're now 6 years old. They've built a huge audience. They're doing a great job covering neighborhoods in Chicago. We need more Block Club Chicagos elsewhere in the country. The Chicago news ecosystem, compared to a lot of others, is relatively healthy. We've seen a lot of digital startups in Chicago. There's Ethnic Media, which is doing well in Chicago and covering communities that have been undercovered in the past. We're also seeing, and we haven't talked a lot about this, but the emergence of content creators as a force in local news. And this survey we did a couple months ago, 30% of people said that they get local news at least once a week from content creators. So these are news influencers who are on social media creating their own content. And, we just had a profile on our site today of some content creators in Chicago, including a woman named Erica Noblesia, I think I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, who has more than 100,000 followers on TikTok, covering the restaurant dining scene in Chicago. She built that audience from scratch. So it can be done. And we're seeing these different forms of news delivery take shape. But right now it feels like we're still in the middle innings of this whole transformation.
Yep. And as I like to remind everyone, we're living in the future. So we'll see how all this pans out with digital media and legacy media, but it's just so important. I think we can all agree on that we want to feel connected. We want to know what's going on in our communities, and local news is a great way of doing that. We can check out this report at the website localnewsinitiative.northwestern.edu. Again, the report is called The State of Local News 2025. And Tim Franklin is a professor and chair in local news at Medill. Tim, I always love to talk media with you, especially local media. Thank you for talking to us today. And thanks for all of your hard work on this report.
Thanks. And thanks for having me on again, Mike. Always good to talk to you.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
You step out of the night when you get lonely. Hey, yeah. Listen for the sounds the city is down here. I know they're down here, right? I know your cars can hear me up.
Oh yes, once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip, in the Chicago Reader, and online at chicagoreader.com. And I love the sound of this, Steve. This band from Chicago called Aura, and There's horns, and you know, I love the horn section. When you have a horn section, it's kind of automatic. I'm all in, you know?
See, I think you typify the average Chicagoan who loves some dang horns. You know, we are known for it, we love it, and that's about all there is to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have, if you think about it, Chicago, this area has just a great sort of pedigree of horn players. And you talk about this in your strip. We've got some great horn players coming out of here.
Yeah, and, you know, of all stripes, too, you know, I mean, you know, obviously we're going to talk about some horn rock today, but, you know, it all goes back to the jazz and the soul and the R&B that, you know, was virtually invented here in Chicago, if not fully. And, yeah, you had guys like it. Jazz guys like Eddie Harris and Von Freeman. You had guys like Gene Barge, who like all but defined the sort of R&B and rock and roll sound, playing on like Chuck Berry records and, you know, all these amazing sort of soul records. And yeah, and then like, you know, Curtis Mayfield obviously rocking the horns hard via Johnny Pate doing these incredible arrangements of these, you know, full on horn sections, which, you know, that stuff very directly sort of inspired the horn rock of the 60s. And, you know, obviously we're talking about the band Chicago, bands like the Buckinghams. You know, it was just a thing here to throw in some horns and have this kind of soulful sound.
I'm so glad that it happened because it's so good. And what we're going to be zeroing in on today, this band called Aura, A-U-R-A. And this band, I mean, they go back to the mid-1960s in some different sort of iterations here. So let's try to make sense of it all here, Steve, because, you know, there are so many bands that played with each other that were one version, they were one name, and then they become another band, and then they morph into... I mean, it's crazy, the web here that has been... woven, as it were. Okay, let's try to figure this out here, Steve. So take us back to the beginning. You got in touch with bassist Jerry Smith, who was playing for a band called The Flock and Aura. Tell us about how all this comes together.
Yeah, you can't really tell the history of Aura without also telling the history of The Flock. And I covered The Flock a long time ago, band I love. Started off as a garage band and then, yeah, turned into actually when Chicago / then known as CTA got signed to Columbia, they got signed as well. Like they were equally poised to sort of be the next big horn rock thing, you know, signed by this cat, James William Gorshio. And, you know, I kind of went into this whole story a long time ago. We're talking over 20 years ago in Secret History of Chicago Music. But it should be brought to people's attention. And I noticed, you know, that The Flock were playing again, sort of utilizing members from both. And yes, Jerry Smith was in both. So he was a good guy to sort of get the story from. He wasn't in all these garage bands going back to the beginning of Aura, which, you know, it more or less, this happened a lot in the day. The top players from the sort of, so-so teen garage bands making the round, they kind of found each other, and they kind of kept going, and they kind of formed these bands that, like, even Chicago came out. There was a band called The Exceptions. There was another one called the Big Three, and they all sort of they came together. You know, the best guys were like, "Hey, I see you," you know, and that's how these bands started. And in a way, you know, that is how the Flock started. And members were in Aura that were in the Flock, and members were in the Flock that were in Aura. And where do we begin?
Yeah, you have the whole story in your column, "The Secret History of Chicago Music," in the Chicago Reader. So we'll just try to simplify it here for our listeners. And Jerry Smith, born in 1947 in Edgewater, he's raised in Albany Park. He's eventually going out to Skokie and Niles. So he is playing kind of on the north side, northwest side of the city. And that's kind of where the story begins, right?
Yeah, and I got to say, it was really good to talk to him, because a lot of sources have it wrong. He was there from the beginning of the Flock. There was this band called The Exclusives that more or less turned into the Flock. And honestly, it's kind of undocumented, that story. Even when I told the Flock's history a long time ago, that info was not exactly out there. So, you know, some people say he joined later, but no, he was there from the inception. And once again, it was these kids sort of making, you know, the local scene and playing in these sort of teen bands, this one called The Exclusives. But even then, they were playing in other ones before that, that sort of formed the Flock. And then the Flock were kind of like the idols of this other band, which went through a few different names, but Four Days in a Night. They were another local, very typical name of the period, and a little bit of a clunky name to show they were a biracial band, because the singer guy, Al Laffin, was like black soul singer and sort of backed by some white boys. So, and he was very crucial. He would go on to be the singer for Aura. And then a couple guys in that band turned into Giant City, 4 days in a Night, named after a place, I guess they would play in Carbondale, a park that was nearby. And there were two guys that sort of also crossed over in both bands who were in 4 days in a Night / Giant City, T.S. Webb and Frank Posa, who I should point out, his son was my manager at Reckless Records. shout to Dylan Posa, great bass player and musician himself. And yes, those two guys basically left to start to join the Flock when the Flock went from a garage band to a horn band. They sort of lived the dream and jumped to the band that they all sort of loved. And, you know, all the musicians sort of left, joined up with some other ones. Supposedly the lineup changed like 50 times. 50 different people might have passed through before they became Aura as we know it. And it was worth it because, you know, they only did one record, but it's a really cool record that sort of touches on all the things we've talked about. It's got that groovy full-on horn section and also like a kind of cool acid rock guitar sound like Terry Kath had in Chicago. And like, but you know, kind of its own thing. It's funky, it's got horns, it's got cool solos, and you know, also this powerful singer, Al Laffin, who's got a really unique voice. Maybe soon we'll see life is free.
I think it's great. You're right. It rocks. It's funky. There are horns. So amen to all of that. But in terms of just how big this band got, this band Aura in Chicago, you say that they were kind of playing the same circuit from Rush Street to Barnaby's. They're also playing VFW halls, but they were an 8-piece band, and so they're not making any money. That's really hard when you have that many people in the band and you're in your early 20s. It was just kind of a struggle.
That's the problem with a horn rock band is that, and a horn section is that, you know, we've seen it in these movies, you know, a couple famous ones, you know, keeping this band on the road with a bunch of guys, it's hard, you know, it's hard when you're a three-piece power trio, you know, let alone eight guys. And, you know, yeah, I mean, they seemed like they were popular locally. I guess Mercury Records really wanted to sign The Flock, but then they signed that deal with Columbia I mentioned. So, you know, when they got, oh, Jerry Smith, I mean, The Flock basically broke up. They just got, I mean, they did do these major tours, did put out a couple big, pretty big records. At least you see them around all the time. And they burned out on this scene. And Aura just never quite, Jerry Smith, who was in both, and sort of once The Flock kind of went down for the first time, joined Aura, you know, I mean, it sounds like they had much bigger tours and it was still very hard. And then it sounded like Aura could just never hop on like that big national tour. Like Mercury had these dreams for them, you know, but it sounds like almost like by the time the record came out, the band was kind of like broken up and had sort of almost like given up because they just weren't really able to take it to the next level.
And what year are we talking about here?
This is about 71, you know, but like the band was basically, you know, done. And, you know, by the time the LP came out in 71, it kind of sounds like so.
Wow. Aura is no more, but I know that there was going to be a Flock reunion concert tonight, November 1st, but that's not happening. So because there was an injury in the band, but do we think Aura is ever going to get back together again?
Sadly, no, because it sounds like, you know, he had a plan to maybe reform, Jerry Smith did, to reform it in like 2000, you know, teens. And then Al Laffin died. He passed away and like a good man, a lot of them are gone. And, you know, several members have passed away, almost half the crew, or more at this point.
Yeah, maybe they'll play some Aura shows at these Flock shows, but tonight not happening at the Park West. So stay tuned. Hopefully that will get back on the schedule. And hey, speaking of schedules, Steve, you are going to be with me and hopefully lots of other people at Fitzgerald's on Saturday, November 22nd for the Outside the Loop 1000th taping. You're going to be there doing this segment live in front of an audience.
I feel like for that 1,000th, you need to like do that thing where you would hit the delay, you know, and go like 1,000, you know, like that. That is huge, man. You just understated that. That is, I every time I feel like I see it, or say it, I'm like, that is an impressive accomplishment. So we just have to say that right here, okay?
Well,
I know you're
you.
Not honking your own horn. Let me honk your own horn for
thank
you.
Thank you.
Yes, because we're talking about horns, right?
That's right. So, you know, all kinds of horns going off. But you're going to be there, so everyone should be there. 3 o'clock, Saturday, November 22nd. We're so excited. I'm so excited that we're going to be there in person and live, and it's going to be awesome. And hey, man, The Secret History of Chicago Music. Everyone should check it out. It is in the Chicago Reader. You can find that column and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He's also a local musician, music historian, and artist, and he rules. Steve, turn up the horn rock, man. It's awesome.
As I always say, stay horny.
I've been sailing all the way back home, dreaming three cars here, sleeping no place left to roam. Stayed in town for a while, seems it got me nowhere bound. Locked doors behind, saving plastics from the sunbound.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 994 is done. Thank you oh so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN Radio studio. A reminder to go ahead and get your tickets for the 1000th taping at Fitzgerald's on November 22nd, 3 p.m. We'll see you there. Have a great week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.